summertime and the saving is easy at Eurospar Supermarkets. Like Lion's Original, 210 tea bags, only €5.99. Inishella Irish Chicken Fillets, 500 grams, only €3.99. Fairy Platinum Plus, 34 dishwasher tablets, only €6.99. And Thorin Wine Range, only €7.99 each. That's great value at Eurospar, your super easy supermarket. Offers available until July 31st in participating stores while stocks last. Enjoy alcohol responsibly.
Coming up on this episode of the Mario Rosenstock podcast.
So Donegh O'Callaghan, of course, who doesn't drink.
Yeah. Yes.
Told Des Cahill, listen, get Tommy up. He'd love to sing a song. And went out onto stage and Des then goes, and Tommy Bow wants to sing a song. It was a sort of like you wish a hole would just open up. But I kind of thought, listen, I'm going to go for it. I'm still a bit tipsy here. So that's where What About Her Eyes and the Black Velvet Band came out. It was just like from hero to zero in my mind. I was just, oh, what have I done? And I remember coming off the stage in the Mansion House and Mary McAleese was there and she gave me a big hug and she goes, thank God you can run fast.
Well, look, it was a massive year for rugby with Ireland in the Rugby World Cup and everything and all the stories that we saw emanating from France. And, you know, so many rugby players, in particular retired rugby players, seem to have great stories to tell. There's so much crack and mischief going on behind the scenes in the changing rooms. And when they're off on tour, and then you and I are then lucky enough to hear all about it, when a sufficient amount of time has passed, I suppose, for them to feel safe to tell their stories and share their stories. Tommy Bow is one of those great former rugby internationals who also happens to be a great storyteller. So I was delighted when he agreed to join me as a special guest here on the Mario Rosenstock podcast. I got some juicy behind-the-scenes stories and gossip, which I think you'll enjoy. But we also talk about his childhood, growing up in a border county when the British Army very much were still a presence there. How he very nearly did not become a professional rugby player. His new career as a TV presenter, known for regular, hilarious gaffes. 10 siblings, anybody? Do you remember that one? He tells me about that one. And his successful clothing and footwear company, which has just turned 10 years old. You're in for a real treat this week on this episode of the Mario Rosenstock podcast.
Nobody knew what was going on. We got down into the hotel lobby, walked into the bar, and there was literally about 50 pints just lined up in the bar. And Ian McGeachan just said, listen, guys, we're not together for a very long period of time. I feel the best way for you to get to know your neighbours, get to know people who you've had fights and conflicts on the pitch with, is to have a pint with them. So we end up getting absolutely rad arse. I said, well, listen, we will catch up soon and thanks so much for talking to us. So I turned around and I looked at the auto queue and, like, you know, your eyes, you're kind of like, that was tough. And I looked at the auto queue and I said, coming up next, we're talking to an influencer who sells farts in a jar. You share a moment with these guys that very few other people, even your family or your wife or partner, they're a part of it, but they're not. And I think that that's what the sanctuary of a change room is. And that's that, looking back on it, is still the bit that I kind of miss the most.
Can I do it?
Please do.
Can I do it, Tommy?
Please do.
You know what it is.
Oh, I do.
It has to be.
Hit me with it.
It must be.
Come on.
Tommy Bo!
Oh, man, I've missed that right. Oh.
My full chat with the great Tommy Bo coming up in just a couple of minutes. But first, it's comedy time. And listen, it must be nearing the end of the year now, you know? I mean, it's Christmas is just around the corner. I wonder what some of our podcasting friends are doing, like David McWilliams. Okay, David, final podcast of the year.
Absolutely. Happy Christmas, John.
Yeah, you too. Ready to go?
Yeah, all set, John. Are we doing retail, isn't it?
Retail.
Okay, let's go.
Hands up, John.
Okay, center.
How are you doing? David here with John. A happy Christmas, John. It's Christmas time.
Have you done your Christmas shopping yet, David?
Great question, John.
Yeah.
No, of course, Christmas comes in Q4,
yeah.
The most important time for retailing in Ireland. So many sectors rely on Q4.
Really does. I remember December 8th was a big date in our diary back in the day.
Yeah, I remember it well, John. Yeah, December 8th, of course.
Yes.
When the cold cheese came up to Dublin. Do you remember that, John? with their big fucking ignorant culty heads on them. Remember the big dopey?
What do you do?
Muck savages, John. Yeah.
Stop it.
I'd remember it well, John.
Oh, no.
We'd nick a couple of naggins of Smirnoff.
Oh, please.
Out of the off license and Dorky and leg it in on the 7A.
You're bunk
onto the bus, we would.
You're
and then we'd pickpocket the bleeding ignorant culties.
You're crazy.
And then kick the bollocks out of them on Henry Street. Remember that, Jolly? Then we'd fence off the gear to Rats Buckley, do you remember? And fucking spend it all on nosebag. Off our tits we were for the bleeding Christmas, Jolly boy. John? John? Happy Christmas, John.
And thanks to David McWilliams, the podcast, of which I'm a big fan, for providing the inspiration for those sketches. And many of you have been in touch during the year saying you enjoyed the David McWilliams parodies. And of course, we have sketches, unique sketches on the Mario Rosenstock podcast every week. And so tune in to listen to those. And thank you for listening to them during the year. Thank you for listening to the podcast, by the way, which has been flying in recent weeks with guests like Al Porter and Micheál Martin and Pascal Donoghue and Dr. Tony Bates. Etc. Great reaction to all those guests. And if you haven't listened to them, I would urge you to scroll back and listen to some of them. But listen, Tommy Bow is waiting in the wings, something he's been well used to all his career. So let's not keep him waiting any longer. It turns out that myself and Tommy have a little bit in common. His dad is from Waterford and I'm from Waterford. So we kick things off there, boy. And listen, I never knew that your father, there's a Waterford connection.
Oh, yes. My dad's Waterford, my mum's Kildare.
Yeah, because you know Waterford, you know Bode, he's a strong Waterford
huge
name.
Huge, that's all I'm going to call it. There's another Tommy Bow down there and he gets all the slagging.
Yeah, there is another Tommy Bow. I actually think I've heard of him because I'm from Waterford.
Oh, are you? Yeah.
You see, this is why I brought it up.
Oh, yeah, cool.
So I was brought up in Waterford.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a Bow Street in Waterford.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I went to Water Park.
Did you? Well, I went and did a talk down at Waterpark Rugby Club there a couple of years ago and all the bows came out. And I swear, I was meant to do a talk and I was guest speaker, which I don't do very often. Actually, I don't do it at all. It was 1:30 in the morning before they asked me to get up and speak. I was like, what is going on? No one wants to hear me talk at this time of the night. So, yeah, we had a great night. The bows are great fun. Yeah, I know we have great time. I don't get to see them too often.
There's a lot of bows down
there. There's a lot of bows, yeah. You don't find them anywhere else.
Can you do the accent?
The Waterford accent, no?
It's not great now.
Not great.
Yeah,
no.
We have to work at that.
It's one of the great at accents.
It's one of the worst. It's one of the hardest accents.
Is it?
Because it's very guttural. So it's like, what are you talking about, boy? Yeah.
Oh, is it?
Your man, Tommy Bow. Tommy Bow. Who the fuck do you think you are, boy?
That's not Waterford, Mario. Sorry, you haven't got that at
all. Obviously, I'm from Waterford. It has to be Waterford.
You don't sound like very Waterford.
Do you want to kick in the fucking hole, boy?
That's it. There you got it.
That's fucking Waterford, boy. John Mullan, boy. Oh, he loves me county, boy.
That's the bows right there.
Yeah. So you know it. But it's very hard to do because it is actually a very distinctive accent.
I love it. And like the thing is with the bows is like there's very few names that go with a bow. So I only worked this out when I had a son because bow lends itself to like you've... Harry Bow, obviously the Swedes.
Yeah.
You've Richard would be Dickie Bow.
Yeah.
You have Les Bow.
Yeah.
You have
Strongbow.
Columbo. You have Strongbow.
Yeah.
You have my wife is Lucy. She's now Elbow. So you end up having a couple of very strict names. So that's why in like my dad there's like Paul the Pilot and there's Paul the Duck Farmer and Paul the like the Butcher.
Yeah.
There's all the load of Pauls.
I haven't heard that one before now.
No, that's a new one. Well done.
Yeah, that's a new one to your collection. Because you've obviously thought about this.
Yeah, I have. No, like, well, you have to because, and like, my wife's dad is called Bill. So she was kind of going, I'd love, you know, but Bilbo Baggins is not great
or Gareth,
either.
For short, Garbo.
Garbo. So, like, quite funny, but also leads to a lot of lot of bullying.
God.
Bobo, that's what I'm going to call my next dog.
Like a clown.
Like B-E-A-U, Bobo.
Oh, yeah, Bobo.
Bobo.
Oh, Bobo, yeah. Nice.
Ah, Bobo.
That's lovely. Did your father go to school in Waterford?
He went Water Park as
did
well.
He?
Yeah, and then he went up to Newbridge.
What's his name?
Paul.
Paul Bow.
Yeah. So Paul the duck farmer Bow. Mm. So he went water park, all like his brother as well. They all, and then they went up to Newbridge. So dad actually was in the last team to win a school's cup in Newbridge College.
Okay. And go. how do we know Tommy Bow from Monaghan then? So what's the Monaghan connection?
He finished college in UCD and went to work. The only job he could get was in Silver Hill Duckling, which is based in Emmyvale, right on the border, which is like the Wagyu beef of duck.
Yeah.
So he came there to work for Silver Hill, and then my mum trained as a physio. She's from Kildare. Only job she could get to work in hospitals was actually in Craigavon Hospital in the north. But she didn't want to live in the north. She lived the closest to it, which was Emmyvale in County Monaghan, and commuted over the border every day. And this is back when they had the big barracks and everything else. And we used to have to sit in the back of the car, go through the barracks, and you'd have the guns and be looking at you, and you get out and they'd check the car and all sorts. So
how would you be nervous during those times?
No, you're like a boy. That's cool.
Yeah. Oh, cool.
Oh, yeah. Like you see these guys with their guns. I was kind of like, class.
Yeah. But of course, when you were growing up, it was coming to the end of the
yeah. So it was 1995, wasn't that the that was the peace process? Yeah. But no, like still, like what age was I? I was probably 11, 12 when that happened. Mm. So I was well used to going across the border. Mm. So. Mm. It was kind of just naturally, you're like, if you grow up with that, you don't really know any difference. Yeah. And I never saw any trouble.
You're brilliantly known for being a famous and wonderful rugby player. And actually, it was only a few weeks ago, 2 weeks ago, I think, I was looking at this thing. You were probably aware of it yourself, that Warren Gatland picked you as in his all-time Lions team.
Yeah.
And I thought that was interesting because Brian O'Driscoll didn't make the team.
I know.
No, Brian O'Driscoll didn't make the team. And of course, I understand the criteria because what he said at the end, Gatland said, was, I picked the players according to what the peak that they were at.
Absolutely.
And of course, O'Driscoll's peak was 01 to 10.
Yes.
And your peak was a bit later.
Well, I was with Warren in the 2009 tour, 2013 tour. So they were the two. So it was South Africa, which was probably one of the best rugby experiences of my life. Yeah. The second test against South Africa was the most physical, brutal rugby match I've ever been a part of. And the closest I've ever seen to that was Ireland and South Africa in their last World Cup. Like the closeness, how it came down to the last few minutes. So, that was probably, I was kind of playing my best rugby ever at that stage. 2013, I was starting to fall off the wagon a little bit. But Drico, to be fair to Warren, he kind of caveated by saying, yes, Brian in the two earlier tours were with. Now, Brian won Six Nations Player of the Year in 2009, but listen, let's not get caught up in the details. I think, Brian being dropped by Warren Gatland in 2013 will always be a bit of a bug to bear with a lot of the Irish fans and Drico, because like that was the first time ever he'd been dropped by a coach. And it was in the third test of the decider. It was 1-1 in the series against Australia. Yeah. Everybody expected Brian O'Driscoll to be picked, but Gatland, I think, picked 10 of his Welsh players going into that game, brought back Jonathan Davies to partner Jamie Roberts in the centre, and Drico got dropped. And listen, it was a massive shock even for us as a team. Like, we were all, like, Drico was kind of the main leader of the squad. Like, it was unreal.
He was.
And for him to be dropped. But something like that, and that's kind of the clever thing about Gatland. And he gets a raw deal. But the one thing that he's very good at, and something that you'll see that in the recent World Cup, is that he doesn't probably have to have the best players on the pitch. He's just a wonderful motivator. Mm. And something like dropping a player of the standard of Brian O'Driscoll, it kind of gives everybody a kick up the arse, kind of thinking, geez, we've really, like, how are we going to do this here? But whatever it was, anyway, it worked. We ended up, we won comfortably in that third test. And even he said, like, I'd love to put Brian on the bench, but having Brian on the bench is not the same impact as someone like a Manu Tuilagi, who could turn a game around.
Because Brian wasn't necessarily a physical impact.
No. He's a clever footballer. Brilliant stage, playing some great rugby. In 2013, he would say himself, he wasn't at the level that he might have been in earlier years.
Oh, but at the risk of never having the guy on my podcast,
yes,
I would say he was slightly past his best in 09.
Be careful.
And, well, he, as brilliant footballer as he was, I think he'd say, if I said to him he'd lost half a yard of pace, he had, listen, even though he was still brilliant.
I know exactly what it's like. Like, listen, rugby is such an attritional game. You are playing it at such a high level, and the step up from playing playing from Leinster or Ulster or Munster or Connacht in the kind of the URC league is you know, to Europe is a big step. The step up from like Europe to the Six Nations is next level. I mean, like, it's massive. And the biggest thing, whenever I went on the Lions in 2009, it was the end of the season. The Ospreys had gone well. We just won the Six Nations that year. I felt peak of my powers, as fit as I could be. Yeah. We were doing training at altitude with oxygen masks. Yeah. We were doing all this crazy stuff. Yeah. And the first day of training, you have 30 of the best players from the four countries coming together. Mm. And the standard and intensity of training was like nothing I'd ever experienced before. I remember going, coming like the next day, the second day of training, heading down for dinner that night. And I was literally having to go down the stairs of my arse because my legs were that wrecked. Right. And I was rooming with the out half, Stephen Jones, the Welsh out half at the time. And we were both tucked up in bed, not in the same bed, separate beds, at 9:30 that night. And we were kind of thinking, oh, we had team building the next day, and it was one of those things, you're like, we have to go off and like team building and like standing on rafts and hope you don't fall. Yeah. The sort of thing that like it looks great and you have these fellas, drill sergeants, shouting at you. That's the last thing we want to do. Yeah. We're wrecked. I can't be dealing with this. And at 9:30, we got a text from Ian McGeachan, who was the head coach at the time. He said, everybody to be down in the hotel lobby at 10 o'clock. And we're like, oh my God, what is this? Like, is this going to be keeping us up on? Like, is this some other team building exercise to really test us? And we got up and nobody knew what was going on. We got down into the hotel lobby, walked into the bar, and there was literally about 50 pints just lined up in the bar. And Ian McGeachan just said, listen, guys, we're not together for a very long period of time. I feel the best way for you to get to know your neighbours, get to know people who you've had fights and conflicts on the pitch with, is to have a pint with them. So we end up getting absolutely rad arse and sing songs, me hanging out with the English lads, and that takes a lot, and sharing the crack with them. And it was brilliant. Like, it was a real, that was a masterstroke.
It's funny you should say that, though, because I've spoken to a few people about this, a few rugby players about this, and when it comes to going on the Lions tours, the Irish and the English players seem to get on very well.
The Irish and the Welsh get on very well.
You think the Irish and the Welsh get on well?
Very oddly, yes.
Yeah. Irish. What about the Irish and the English? And I said, why? I won't say the player.
Yeah.
And I said, why? And he went, because, he said, we both know the gig, Ireland and England.
Oh, yeah.
We both know it. Yeah. It's kind of a known entity.
Yeah, of course.
And so they kind of, ironically, do get on well. And that tallies with other stuff I've heard as well. A bit, for example, taxi drivers. Mm-hmm. They say, who are the best fans? And he went, oh, no word of a lie, right? I know this sounds strange, but the fucking English fans are the best. And I went, why? Because they know the drill, right? They know they oppressed us for 800 years. And they're almost sorry for it, right? And they are huge tippers. Huge tippers. Now, the French, they fuck off to the Shelburne with their bagel and they won't spend a penny. Scots, tight as an ass chuff, right? Don't like the Welsh.
Yeah.
But the English. So,
fair enough.
But is there anything that registers there with you?
With the English, like, say, for instance, someone like an Owen Farrell. Like, Faz is ultimate competitor. Like, Owen Farrell is like a Johnny Sexton. Like, you know, once you step out onto the grass, they are feckers. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, they're the sort of people you love to have on your team. They're the last people you want to be up against. Just fierce competitors, drive their own team, drive you, drive the opposition. But see, actually, when you step off the pitch, unbelievable crack. Like, listen, everybody talks about Johnny Sexton, things, you see the scowl across his face, but see Johnny in the team room, you know, that evening playing pool, like, the crack, he's brilliant. Loves a forfeit.
He goes into game mode.
Once he's in the game mode, man, he's the most competitive man, and he's had this vision. He just, like, everything slots into place for Johnny Sexton, apart from us when we don't slot into place for him, and then he lets rip. And Owen Farrell's like that too.
Just a couple of players, just a couple of quick rugby questions for you, just about your career. One of the things that I noticed about you in your rugby career, you really you produced for Ireland, and what I mean by that is you played really well a lot of the time for Ireland. In other words, being in the Irish shirt brought out that best in you. Not all really good players produce. Some players kind of underperform. Some players take a long time to perform. You really did perform.
We see you forget this, right? So actually, I ended up. So I did, because I live on the border, I actually ended up going to secondary school in Armagh, did A-levels. completely cocked them up. Didn't go the way I wanted to. I was giving up rugby. I didn't make Ireland schools. I barely played for Ulster schools. Didn't get picked for any academies. So I was heading off to Scotland to go on the piss.
Okay.
And my A-levels didn't go well, and my rugby coach actually ended up getting in touch with Alan Clark, who was head of the Ulster Academy at the time, and said, listen, Tommy's exams hasn't gone well. There's a course in Belfast that I think he might enjoy, and I think this guy has got serious potential if you give him a chance. So he said, right, we've got a trial next week. We'll slot him in. He can go at full back. We'll give him a slot. So I actually had just come back from a holiday in Tenerife with a bunch of my mates. I had bleach blonde hair with a blue stripe down the middle of it. It was absolute. And I had to turn up to this Ulster rugby trial. Like, yeah. It was horrific. But I ended up having the best game of rugby in my life. Ended up going to another trial, played really well. Got into the Ulster Academy as a wild card. That was 18 years of age. I ended up getting capped for Ireland at 20. So it all happened really fast. And I then went through a few years of playing for Ulster, playing okay for Ulster, got capped a number of times for Ireland, but wasn't good.
Not at the beginning.
No, I was awful. So I actually think I'm one of the only players ever to get a 0 out of 10 in the paper.
From who?
Neil Francis, who I bumped into quite recently, actually.
And I have as well.
It was quite awkward. Yeah. So Franino gave me a 0 out of 10.
Like, especially when the guy that rated you 0 out of 10 is 19 stone and 6'6".
Exactly. I mean, what does he know about wing play? To be fair, and this was in the Six Nations.
Yeah.
So we played Italy away from home. I didn't have a great game in that one. No, Italy at home, but I scored a try. If you had kind of video ref nowadays, probably wouldn't have been a try. Right. Listen, that's worry about that. Then went away from home, played against France, and we were trying out this new line speed defence, the sort of defence that you see teams doing all the time. We were thinking ahead of ourselves. This is Eddie O'Sullivan thinking outside the box. Set your hair on fire, I used to say. So literally, my job was to shoot from the outside, come right in and just smash the guy, smash the winger out the back. We knew the play. We knew, we'd seen it in the video analysis, the whole lot. So 5 minutes into the game, ball comes off the line, top of the line out for France. They give it out to the out half, Michalak throws it out the back to Heymans. I come sprinting out. This is my moment. This is what we trained. All of a sudden, and now I'm blaming the boots because a bad workman blames his tools. I had these new blades. New boots. So I kind of like sprinted out of the blocks, but he's a small fella. He put a bit of footwork on. So I kind of hit the brakes a bit and slipped, fell backwards, completely missed him. He went round me. Two passes late, Rougerie was in under the post, scored a try. France 7-0 up. And things went progressively downhill from there. So much so, I think we were losing by 40 points at halftime.
Yeah.
I got taken off after 45 minutes. Andrew Trimble came on, had a stormer, pulled it back. We nearly won the game. And I ended up thinking, right, I'll keep my head down, you know, avoid the coaches. There's no real social media at this stage. Won't read the papers. Get myself to the hotel in Killiney Castle or wherever we were at the time and get myself ready for training Monday morning. And Sunday night, I got this message from a friend of mine. He says, you wouldn't believe what that bollock said about you in the paper.
Zero.
I said, what are you talking about? He goes, sure, didn't he just give you a 0 out of 10?
Tommy O.
Yeah. So I got a 0 out of 10, didn't get picked, and didn't get picked for the next 3 or 4 years.
Okay.
So actually.
So it was in your mid to late career that you bloomed.
Yeah. So it was probably from, I made the decision. So I didn't get picked for the World Cup in 2007, the nightmare in France. And that was probably one of the darkest days because all the way up until that, I'd been in the Irish 30-man squad and they brought in Brian Kearney, who was a rugby league convert. He came in, took my place. And it was a big blow. I had to go, went to see a psychologist. Like, you know, it's one of these things that a real setback because I'd had the 0 out of 10. Things weren't going well for me. And I ended up then making the decision that I would go to the Ospreys and play in Wales. And that was not the done thing. Nobody kind of within the Irish system had ever left the Irish teams, Irish provinces. But I felt that whatever I'm doing here at the minute, I felt I was playing well for Ulster, but it just doesn't seem to be enough to get myself into the Irish team. And I thought, if I can go and play in this Welsh team that they just won the Grand Slam, 13 of the players were Ospreys, I thought that this could, so a bit of a kick up the arse, a bit of trying something new, and it totally reinvented my career.
That was it?
Yeah, totally.
The fresh page.
Big time. Listen, going over to a new team, listening, being completely written off, knowing that this is my opportunity, like either make or break. And they played a style of rugby that really suited me.
And did you feel... you sort of felt like a bit relaxed in that environment, coming from the outside almost.
Yeah, well, little. No, not at all. The complete opposite. Like, well, the thing is, and I would say you look at a lot of the players who stay at Leinster. Like, this is.
No, I meant, did you feel pressure to get into the Ireland squad or less pressure? Being an Ospreys.
Oh, listen, the thing was as well is that when you're playing for a foreign team, if it's a 50-50 call between me and an Irish player, they have to pick the Irish player. So I knew for me to play for Ireland, I had to be, you know, 10%
better.
But did
that relax you in a way?
No, it pushed me. Like, I'm one of these people that love, you know, the competitiveness comes out. Mm. So going to a new team, kick me out of my comfort zone, push me to really excel myself. They played great rugby. And then at the same time, any time... So the good thing is as well, because I could have gone to France or could have gone to England. But the thing was, Declan Kidney was the coach at the time. So if he wanted to go watch me play in England or France, he had to book a separate flight to go and watch it. Yeah. Where at the Ospreys, we're in the same league. You'd be playing against an Irish province once every 3 or 4 weeks.
Right.
You're
on the radar.
And any time we were playing against an Irish province, like, that was my chance to shine. And yeah, like, I loved it. And I really, you went over there, you were the Irish, mad Irish man from, you know, in Swansea in Wales, like, you could do whatever you want.
And then you had this storied career, one of the best wingers we've ever produced. And I wanted to ask you a couple of technical questions, actually, funnily enough, because it's not all general here. But
this is a winger. Remember, I stand on the wing.
Oh no,
hair,
it's about winging stuff. I know, right? It's about winging stuff. It's about winging stuff.
Put the ball in the corner.
I'm winging it as well. Like, so anyway, but. Were you fast? Obviously, everybody has to be fast to be a winger, but I'm kind of interested to know how fast you were. So were you, for example, the fastest in the squad generally?
I was one of the fastest. Yeah, listen, I was deceptively quick. I have a long stride, so I don't look. So people would watch me going, sure, he's not fast at all compared to somebody like a Luke Fitzgerald who was just very zippy, very fast feet. So,
but you were fast.
In all the speed tests, I was right up there, I'd say I was up there top one or two all the time.
Really?
Yeah, so particularly around that sort of time whenever I was at... You know, at my best level.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, because so another was a kind of to play at.
Whenever I was playing well and no injuries. I mean, that's the big thing. Like, we were talking about, say, O'Driscoll and O'Gar. Like, a lot of players, they get to that stage where it's experience keeps them in it as much.
Oh yeah,
because their body does. Like, once you start to get a few operations and your knees and your hips and your back start tightening up, like it does like a yard or 5 yards of pace.
2009 when we won the Grand Slam. Yeah. Everybody remembers that, you know, and everybody kind of remembers where they were. Were you at your peak around that time?
Yeah, that was when kind of like 08 till probably 2013. 2013 is probably
the Welsh match in
that was special.
It really was special, and you were such a big part of that.
One of the biggest days and worst days of my career.
Why one of the worst?
Well, obviously, winning the Grand Slam, scoring a try, first time in 61 years, like. Amazing to be a part of. Family there, night out in Wales, crack was mighty. But we celebrated, myself, Jordan Murphy, and Mervyn Murphy, the video analyst. So we thought, Merv, we thought, we got to make the most of this. Like, this is pretty epic. We need to really celebrate this, lads. So as anyone else, kind of like, the blinkers kind of go on, you don't really realise that everybody kind of like siphles off and you're the only ones left at the party. So we'd ordered 5 bottles of champagne. Turned out there was only 3 of us left to drink it. So when everybody came down in the morning, the 3 of us were there still in our suits, but them turned inside out, trousers inside out, suits inside out, with our ties round the head. And Declan Kidney came in and looked at us going, oh my God, what is going on here? So anyway, they were like, right, let's try and sober this lot up, get them on the flight, get back to Dublin. But we went to the Mansion House. So we had to get to the Mansion House, and there was this whole big celebration live on telly, 9,000 fans on Dawson Street.
And actually, now it's coming back, and you guys were kind of hammered.
Kinda.
You were all woolly.
I couldn't really see how many people were there.
But nobody cared.
So Donegh O'Callaghan, of course, who doesn't drink.
Yeah. Yes.
Told Des Cahill, listen, get Tommy up. He'd love to sing a song.
I love it. So, was this the Velvet Band?
Black Velvet Band. So we were in the Mansion House. Yeah. You had... the Taoiseach was there, you know, the president was there, you know, all the dignitaries were there, and they were very much keeping me and Jordan and Merv in the corner, out of sight. And anyway, we went out onto stage, and Des then goes, "And Tommy Bow wants to sing a song." And at this stage, like, it was a sort of like, you wish a hole would just open up, but I kind of thought, listen, I'm going to go for it. I'm still a bit tipsy here. So, yeah, and you can see, I didn't know that all the lads were in the semicircle behind me, kind of going like, don't, like, you know, don't sing. So don't stitch me up, lads. So that's where What About Her Eyes and the Black Velvet Band came out. And anyway, it was just like, you know, from hero to zero in my mind. I was just, oh, what have I done? And I remember coming off the stage in the Mansion House, and Mary McAleese was there, and she gave me a big hug, and she goes, "Thank God you can run fast."
Very good.
So, so yeah, that was
that's glorious. It is glorious.
But, and to be fair, listen, it was probably one of the best things I ever did. Like, looking back on at the time, my brother texts me going, "Oh my God, I want the ground to swallow up and eat you." Like, you know, that's, you know, that, you know, these text messages come through. What have you done? But then it actually, and now I see it, you know, in life after rugby, like, players with a bit of personality who kind of are happy to have a bit of crack. You think of James Lowe and Mac Hansen within the Irish team. Like, the supporters love them because they're normal. They're having a crack. They're not talking about the process and next game. And me doing that and showing that I enjoy a few pints and not afraid to
correct.
Make a, I mean, an arsehole myself. I think people
correct.
Like that.
People love look, for example, for starters, people love a little look behind the scenes.
Yes.
And you showing your real self is, in a sense, looking behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Also, people love reality, truth. And by being a little bit vulnerable, by being a little bit, a little bit three sheets to the wind, as my grandmother used to say, people adore that because you're not in robot mode.
Exactly. And you know? You're Irish, you know, and we're proud to that. And we all make a bit of a fool of ourselves now and again, not just in front of 9,000 people.
Come here, a couple of more quick questions. Who's the best player you've ever played with?
Best player I've played, listen, O'Driscoll, fantastic player. Like, he was, and particularly when you went to the Lions, you know, he would stand out. Some of the skills that he would do was just next level. And it was the fact that it wasn't just the skills, he was able to put his body on the line. Some of the tackles, like, you think back and some of the matches, and maybe concussion protocols weren't what they are nowadays. And like, he just, he was not afraid to put his body on the line for his country, for the Lions. But I have to say, Shane Williams, the winger, he is 5'9" at a push. He is not your stereotype. In a game full of giants, he was a small guy who won World Player of the Year, and I just hated marking him because he could go left of you, he could go right of you, he could go over the top, he'd go under your legs. I mean, you couldn't lay a finger on him. And I actually went to the Ospreys to almost to learn off him, because he was unbelievable how he'd turn up at scrum half, at out half, on the wing, and just show me as a winger, it's a waste of time spending your time out on the wing waiting for the ball to come to you. If you want to have an impact on the match, you've got to get your hands on the ball. And that's actually something that became a massive part of my game.
And but also, not only has it become a part of your game, but now it's de rigueur, a part of world rugby.
Huge.
So James Lowe and Mac Hansen are just as likely to be first receiver as Johnny Sexton.
Well, what's the point having your fastest and your best footwork out on the wing whenever they should be in the middle taking on the big fat forwards?
Sure, Tommy, when you were in 1994, what age were you?
1994, I was 10.
Okay, I was 24.
Okay.
And I was down in Waterford.
Okay.
In Dunmore with the boys.
So you have a big birthday coming up then too.
I was down in Waterford.
Okay.
And I was with the boys. And we were on a drinking weekend, and we're having a great crack down at Dunmore East. And of course, you know, finished the Saturday with the old annual match in Twickenham, you know, on the TV.
Love
Ireland
it.
And England. You know, here comes another terrible defeat, and of course, something miraculous happened. The ball came out of the scrum, it moved to the out half, it moved across to the centre. The centre hit, threw it to a fella called Simon Gagan, this mop of floppy blonde hair who had a kind of an English accent and played for Ireland, and he was a solicitor, and he ran like the devil, and we went, "Go on, the fuck, Gagan!" And then he went in the corner, and Ireland had scored a try in Twickenham. a miraculous try where we passed the ball to the fucking winger. And we hadn't seen it in about 15 years. Now, you see, nowadays, wingers are everywhere. And we Ireland score 5 tries a game.
I know.
We used to score 2 tries a championship,
oh my God,
Tommy.
I used to love Simon Gagan. He was my hit, the mop of hair. Like, I used to go to the old Lansdown Road. And the wonderful thing about Simon Gagan was, like, he used to kick it long and he'd be back in the 22 and he'd catch it. And he'd sprint full blast back to the defensive. But by the time he got to the defensive line, he was bollocks, Jimmy. Yeah. Like, he wasn't, there was no footwork or anything then, Jimmy. But when he was going for it, man, the whole crowd was up. And exactly, it was back when Irish rugby, that was a big thing.
Yeah.
So, like, I grew up in those days. My dad used to take me all the time to the old Ireland matches in Lands End Road. And, like, that's where you get the love of it. And it's great. And I think that's, like, it's there. Jeez, it's there in spades at the moment. Such a massive following.
Was it incredibly proud to put on the Irish jersey?
Listen,
incredibly proud moment.
When I mentioned to you earlier on, like, that dream had passed. Like I said to you earlier on, that I grew up, that I didn't think that it was going to happen. That I obviously dreamt of becoming an international rugby player representing my country, but never getting picked for the academy, not getting picked for Ireland schools. You kind of think that that dream is gone and you have to move on. So to be given a kind of a back door back into it again, and then for it to happen. Like, I remember the first time I heard I was being picked for the Irish squad, and I played 4 or 5 matches for Ulster Rugby and for Ulster, and I was this young 20-year-old, and I had the bleach blonde hair at the end. That was kind of a thing at the time.
But even Drico did it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's not saying much.
Let's not talk too much.
He
about
also
that
had
now
the schmig.
Oh God,
I couldn't grow one, thankfully. No.
But he just couldn't pull off the bleached hair now.
No. But at that stage,
sorry, I'm slagging,
like,
him off all the time.
It was Brando Driscoll, like, Jimmy. He got everything else was picked for him to wear. He had to wear, so it was kind of his thing, the hair, but. I got told, I remember we were doing a signing session for Ulster, and you had, like, David Humphreys and you had a couple of Ulster rugby players, and all the fans, you had this huge big queue of supporters there, and I was just you had to stand in certain spots in the car park, and nobody was coming to ask for my autograph. I was just standing there on my own, and next to this TV camera came over and it says, "Tommy Bow, how does it feel to be picked in the Ireland squad?" And I thought they were taking, like, I hope that footage never comes up again, because I was a rabbit in the headlights. I didn't know what they're talking about. And it turns out that I got picked. I looked at my phone and my dad, loads of missed calls. Yeah. But I was a student, so I, like, had to reverse the charges to ring my dad.
I love that.
To kind of ring him back. And he's like, "Tommy, you're in the t-." And, like, so going down and meeting, like, Paul O'Connell Driscoll and Malcolm O'Kelly and Anthony Foley, heroes. And then, you know, a couple of weeks later, I played against the USA. So that's back in 2004. Yeah. So, like, and it was in the old Lansdowne Road. It was against the USA. You had the national anthem. My parents were there. I still have all the letters, you know, that I'd been sent. Like, it was special. And sometimes I go home and you look at that. It's nice. Yeah, it's nice. It's probably the highlight of my career.
Every Audi is designed with you in mind. From the fully charged electric driving of the all-new Audi Q6 e-tron to the hybrid petrol and diesel engines of the Audi A3 Sportback and A6 Saloon. Because how you drive is very much a personal choice. And of course, with every Audi, that choice is never a compromise. Book your test drive of the 242 range at your local Audi dealer. Audi. Vorsprung durch Technik.
Do you develop close personal bonds with few people, few guys in the squad? And if so, do they stay with you after you leave rugby?
Yeah, I think that, like, I did something with a couple of players there the other day that I haven't seen them in 2 or 3 years. And we had to do this kind of event, and we all were handed a microphone. They're kind of said, "What are you going to talk about?" And they kind of had this structure. And then we just said, "You know what?" Because the crack, you know, when you share a change room with somebody for 10 years, you forget the funny stuff that you've been through, the trauma that you've been through, the winning, the losing. And those sort of things, like, I might not see Donegh O'Callaghan, for instance, for 5 years, Donegh and Tomás O'Leary, but all of a sudden we get together for a coffee, or, you know, I might be having a beer, and, like, it just floods back. Same with, like, and it's something special. Like, when you share a moment with these guys that very few other people, even your family, your wife or partner, they're a part of it, but they're not. And I think that that's what the sanctuary of a change room is. And that's that, looking back on it, is still the bit that I kind of miss the most.
Yeah, I'm interested to hear that. You know that there's people who listen to this podcast live.
What?
There are people listening live to this podcast.
Yeah, good afternoon to you.
Yeah. And some of them ring in.
All right, okay,
yeah, so
brilliant.
So there's people on the phone now.
All right,
like,
okay.
So Ryle Nugent is on the phone.
He is not, is he?
Say hello.
Love
to
him. Ryle, how are you?
Tommy, it's so great to talk to you. I've missed you. You know, my career went down the toilet when you retired because I had nobody to shout. Can you give me one more chance to do my bit?
Ryle, do you know, I've missed it as much as you have.
But surely you have. Can I do it?
Please do.
Can I do it, Tommy?
Please do.
You know what it is.
Oh, I do.
It has to be.
Hit me with it.
It must be.
Come on.
Tommy Bo!
Oh, man, I've missed that, Ryle.
Oh, you know, one time I appeared on the Ian Dempsey Breakfast Show. And I actually wrote the song to the tune of Frozen. Tommy Bo, can't live without you anymore. It's incredible.
James Lowe just doesn't have the same sound, does it?
No, it just didn't even scan. James Lowe.
Oh, Ryle, I've missed you.
Oh,
listen,
Ryle,
we must catch up.
That's brilliant, Ryle. He lives near me and it's great to hear that he's listening to the show. Oh, my God, fantastic.
Listen, hasn't been the same without him.
We talk about rugby a lot, and there'll be more calls, but we talk about rugby a lot. I'm talking about rugby a lot to you, obviously, for obvious reasons. But let's move on a little bit, because
okay,
there's so much more to you, Tommy, and you've kind of reinvented yourself. I mean, I think of other people like Gary Lineker, who moved from sport into very much mainstream broadcasting.
Yeah,
very
yeah.
Well. And now you're doing that as well. And it's been like the proverbial, sorry for using the word duck, to water again, because, you know, people are enjoying you. You love it. You like it. It's live presentation, live TV. You've had some great viral moments. And how is, you know, you work with a great person, Muirin and Alan.
Yeah.
And they're real pros. Muirin has been on the podcast.
She has.
She
I've heard it.
Today FM.
Yeah.
I know Muirin very well. I love it. Yeah, you're good at it.
I really enjoy it. I have to say, from the off, I think you've the record for the fewest questions we've ever asked in an interview.
Oh, yeah, I remember.
You came out, like, we never do pre-records, but we heard you were keen to come on. We were like, yes, let's do. So we stayed behind. And normally our interviews would be kind of 8 to 10 minutes because you're the news and us talking shite, whatever else. But we did the pre-record. So we asked you 2 questions and you spoke for 12 minutes. You had us. Remember, it was a story with your hand in the pocket from Glen Rowe. Oh, man, that.
Well, the thing about
I
it was, right?
God,
so I appeared
I
on,
laughed.
Just for the listeners, I appeared with Tommy and Muirin, and it was just such a nice, warm atmosphere. And they're both on the couch, and they're both looking at you, and they're both listening to you. And of course, listening is key to bloody well doing this gig.
Well, it is, unless the guest just goes off in the time. Like, because because you know yourself, you kind of have like structure. Like, we get a bundle of notes, read through it all, kind of going like, we think we'll go this angle. You know, now we have 9 to 12 interviews
every
day.
You know, that all goes out the window if you're comfortable.
Well, yeah, comfortable. And if you have somebody who you know, listen, we might just have to let this one off the leash.
Yeah.
And we asked the initial question about whatever else, and then Muirin brought up the thing. He said, oh, I haven't told that story. Shall I tell that story?
Yeah.
And off he went. Oh,
well,
my God.
I told the story.
I swear that was
and
so
at the end of
funny.
It, at the end of it, we all gave each other a hug and went, thanks very much. And you stayed by for the pre-record. And then Muirin texted me later, or she even said, you should do that in your show, your live show. And I swear to you, I texted Muirin a few months ago and I said, Muirin, I hope just wanted to let you know that I did the encore to my show every night was the story about Glen Rowe. Not only that, I went to the RTE archives and I got the scene so that at the end of my story, the audience are peeled over with laughter because they're going, oh, Jesus, it's so awful. It's so awful, the story. And then I went, and they think it's over. And I go, and it's not over, because I knew if I wanted to come in front of you today, I'd have to go the full hog out. So this week I went to the RTE archives and it's on a massive screen.
Oh,
and I show them the scene and they go, for God's sake. And it's me 30 years ago.
Standing ovation.
So it's feckin'.
And if you want to hear about that story, go see Mario Live, because you will be bent over. I mean, that had me
story.
In such a laugh. But yes, Ireland M, when you leave rugby, unfortunately, we're not like soccer players. We can't just go off on the golf course, put the feet up. We have to move on and find a new life after rugby. And a lot of guys go to become teachers or business development and try to bring business in. I obviously have the clothing and shoe business, which I'm a big part of, but I kind of, to try and keep a brand going, it's easy to do it when you're a professional rugby player because you're kind of cool. Hip, you know, you're a rugby player, but all of a sudden become a retired rugby player, which isn't so cool because there's an awful lot of them out there. So
there are.
Punditry was not really something for me. Like O'Driscoll's great at it. Johnny Sexton will be amazing at it. Paul O'Connell, Ronan O'Gara, excellent, because they've always been involved in the decision making and the you know tactics. I was a winger. I stood there.
There aren't that many winger pundits.
Not many, and if they are, they probably don't know what they're talking about. Yeah. Me included. So I kind of felt that.
That doesn't say much for Shane Horgan.
Well, Shaggy's great too, but he's controversial, and that's what you kind of got to do to kind of keep yourself in there. And the thing is with Shane is that Shane was there for a while until the next player retires, and you kind of push down the pecking order, and all of a sudden you get less and less gigs. So I kind of thought, well, listen, if I'm going to try and give TV a go, because I feel I have an opportunity there, why not try presenting?
How did you try presenting?
I looked at Lineker. I swear, Gary Lineker, you have Sue Barker, you have a number of different people have tried it. And I remember listening to a lot of interviews with Gary Lineker, and he kind of spoke about how he knows the inside of the change room in Wembley. Like, I know the inside of the change room in Twickenham or the Aviva State. I know what a coach would be saying. So I think I could give a different perspective to the viewers from, you know, asking questions of my peers who I know what, you know, what something maybe somebody in the media might not know. And I thought that would be a really interesting angle to go. So I ended up then, I did a few kind of things. I was playing with Ulster at the time. BBC, Ulster, Northern Ireland gave me, I did like a carpool karaoke. I did a few bits and pieces. And from there, I did an interview with the Irish Times, said that I'd like to go into presenting. Somebody from Air Sport spotted it, asked me, okay, would you like to come in for a showreel? I did a couple of screen tests for that, got that. Good. And then all of a sudden from there, Ireland AM opportunity. So like, it's very like rugby, you know, like you have to throw yourself in at the deep end. Yeah. A bit like going to the Ospreys, push yourself outside your comfort zone. Yeah. You never know where it can take you. And my God, Ireland AM in those early days, I was a rat. Like,
were you?
Well, I'd never read the newspaper. I was a rugby player. Like, I avoided newspapers because I got a 0 out of 10 in them. I mean, like, that's where you go to get bad news.
Okay. So all of a sudden, bad papers are just bad news.
Bad news. And particularly trying to read them in an auto queue.
Well, there you go. It's funny. Just a quick story about an auto queue, because I did a rugby show a few years ago with Donegal O'Callaghan.
Yeah, great.
And we did it on Virgin, and which was TV3 at the time still. Or maybe it was Virgin. But anyway, we did 6 episodes, and it was when Ireland won the Grand Slam. So it was actually building towards a great time. But Donegal was only able to come into the show at the very last moment. You know the way rugby players are, right?
Of course.
So I was there rehearsing and prepping the show for a couple of weeks with the team. And then he said, now the deal is, Mario, Donica's only able to come in the night of the first show. And we're there, that's fine, we'll wing it. I know Donica. Uh-huh. I've done stuff with him before. He's very natural. And so hilarious. They had all this stuff ready on autocue, right? And Donica comes in at 7 o'clock, show's live at 8. Donica flies in at 7. And they go, right, Donica, we have your autocue ready. And he's there, it's a great, the night is great, lads. Me no like he autocue. And basically, they all shat their pants because they went, sorry, the whole thing is autocue.
Oh, really?
Yeah, well, like for presenters, and except when you talk to somebody.
Yeah, yeah.
And they had all this stuff, and their presenter, Donica, is going, me no like he autocue, like as if it's not a problem. And we're there an hour to go, and we went to just take down the autocue and just wing it. I'll do all the autocue stuff, and Donica just speaks off the top of his head.
And to be no better man. No better. Like, that guy is the funniest man ever.
He's really funny.
Oh, he's naturally just a hilarious guy. So, yeah, autocue would ruin Donica. We're actually just off the cuff. He's brilliant.
Yeah, he's a real, really natural. One of Ireland's real natural thing. Yeah.
I love spending time with Donica. He's such a laugh.
It was great because I nearly lost him the first week because we were, I always talk nonsense, and he was getting to know me, and I was there, I was describing him in front of him, and I was going, yeah, you're that thing that the French describes as joli laid. And he went, what? Joli laid? What's that? And I went, it means beautiful ugly. And he went, what? And there's a concept of somebody who looks, their looks are weird, strange.
Yeah.
So when you look at them, they go, he could be a Dolce & Gabbana model, or he could be Shrek. And sometimes he can turn his head and you go, ooh la la, it's Dunica. And then he'll go, what? And you go, oh no, it's Shrek again.
Oh my God, he's back. No, who's that guy?
Enormously expressive face.
Yeah.
And you know, black hair, brown eyes.
He doesn't
blue
even
eyes,
need
black
filters.
No, but, so he can look really stunning.
Yeah.
And then another, and then a moment later he can snarl or something and he looks like a monster. It's called, but anyway, there's a word for it in French.
Jolie laide. Oh,
jolie laide. A person who has that face that they can look beautiful,
okay,
but also quite monstrous at times as well.
He gets a tough deal because he is very naturally funny, but he's actually one of the most professional athletes I ever worked with.
Yeah,
it's unreal that he has, like, he carries a notebook everywhere. Yeah. And when he ticks off all the things, like little jobs, he's meticulous, ticks them all off, it kind of like clears his head, and then he can be jolly laid all he wants. And he's absolutely hilarious.
So the TV, right? So just, that's going great. And be honest with me then.
Yeah.
Would you like to stay in that area? And where, not that this isn't a great place to be, but would you like to continue and do more in that area?
No, I love it. Yeah. Like, listen.
Is there no end? Well, is there no limit?
I'll never get.
Is there no limit, Tommy?
There's no limit. There is no limit. No limit.
Yeah.
There's no way I'm ever going to replace running out on the Aviva again. You know, like, that was the dream growing up, going representing your country. So you have to find something else. And see, doing Ireland M, it's an early start. You have to get prepped early. But I kind of get the professionalism almost that was ingrained in us as a rugby player. I love that, the discipline. And there's very few other jobs where you get the adrenaline rush of 7 o'clock in the morning, sitting down with a government minister opposite you, or talking about the riots from last week, where you kind of have to be on the ball, know what you're talking about, and then be able to deal with, well, that was absolutely desperate. Now, coming up next, we're making cheesecake in the kitchen.
Yeah.
So the gear changes.
It is weird, yeah.
You're kind of like, you have to be on. And I love the...
And you are actually...
The crack.
You actually did the fastest gear change in the history of television, I think, didn't you?
Which one?
It was the one where you did the 10... Is it the 10?
Oh, 10 siblings. Oh, God, yeah.
But that
so
was
funny.
But I've never seen a gear change faster.
You know what?
Describe that to the listeners.
I think, to be honest,
who
it's
didn't
hard
see it on
to
viral.
Describe, but I think you need to just YouTube it. Mm. So if you want to have a laugh, it literally will put a smile on your face at my expense, but I don't mind. Tommy Bow, 10 siblings. So we're interviewing Seamus O'Reilly, who is a brilliant author, brilliant columnist as well. And he wrote a book about his family, his growing up, but also about him and his 10 siblings and what happened when their mother died, right? But this happened like 10, 15 years ago. So we had Seamus on, and on these interviews, you kind of go to the breaks, you pull up Skype, and this was mid-COVID. So I was chatting away to him in the break, and I probably should have done my prep, should have read what is coming up in the auto queue, but I was too busy. Something was going on with his microphone. We were having a bit of a laugh. I said, oh, Seamus, listen, we're coming back on. We'll be on air in 10 seconds. And all of a sudden, then Claire McKenna, who was presenting with me at the time, said, now, Seamus O'Reilly, he and his 10 siblings. Now, I knew he had 10 siblings. I don't know why, but I went, 10 siblings. And then she goes, sadly lost their mum. And it's the,
your face it's collapsing.
It's like, oh, I fucked up here, haven't I?
Yeah. Another person would have been, let's say, roasted alive for it. You got away with it.
Well, because
people liked you first.
Well, the thing. Well, so there's a few things to this. I didn't realize. So the YouTube clip or online clip makes it look like I've just gone, and the whole interview stopped.
Yeah.
I didn't even realize I'd made a mistake. Yeah. I just carried on. So Seamus, tell us about the new book. Right, that's wonderful. And it was only that afternoon. Yeah. I was at home and my mother-in-law was there, and I got a text message from somebody who I haven't heard from in a long time with just like 3 laughing emojis. So I was like, oh, what's going on? He goes, oh, the show, that was so funny. Yeah. And I was like, oh, the cookery segment. Yeah, like we had a good laugh with Catherine Lade and the kid. I don't know who was in the kid. And then he goes, have you not looked at your phone yet? And I looked at Twitter, and I swear to God, I was like thousands of mentions.
Yeah.
And then I watched it, and like, listen, it is, it's comedy.
That's
gold.
Great.
It's Alan Partridge, eat your heart out.
Yeah.
But I have to say, I have probably one of those at least once a week. Mm. I mean, like, I'm kind of... It just, I think that that's what people kind of like about me on Ireland M, is that I don't try to be too professional. I'm not very professional. I'm certainly not polished. But I kind of just go a bit like the Black Velvet Band. Yep. You know, we all make cock-ups and...
Be yourself.
And rough and smooth. Listen, eventually, someday, I'll probably say the wrong thing and, you know, it'll be meant in jest or it won't be meant bad. But that is the, unfortunately, this showed me how dangerous Twitter is. That if something gets clipped up without a context... Yeah. And how far and quick it can spread. Yeah. It's actually quite frightening.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, the worst, in a way, the worst thing you can be is not noticed at all, you know?
Listen, like, honestly, I've had that many car crash things. Like, I mean, what are some of the ones? Like, we had this one time and it was a really sad, really, really sad interview. And it was me one-on-one. And I can't remember what it was. Well, I can, but I don't want to go into it. But it was a really sad interview. And like, we were all kind of, I was talking to the person on Skype and we were kind of saying, listen, just don't worry about it. You'll get through this and, you know, we'll catch up soon, whatever else. And obviously everybody in the gallery, the producer was so engrossed in it as well. And they're meant to be the people on top of what's coming up next and changing the autocue, whatever else. And I said, well, listen, we will catch up soon. And thanks so much for talking to us. So I turned around and I looked at the autocue and, like, you know, your eyes, you're kind of like, flip, that was it. Yeah, that was tough. And I looked at the autocue and I said, coming up next, we're talking to an influencer who sells farts in a jar.
Oh my God. I actually remember the farts in a jar, actually.
Oh my God.
I remember talking about that in a meeting going, is this farts in a jar?
I said, this girl actually, and like she was, and like she put little flower petals in the bottom of the jar to soak up the smell. And then we actually did the interview with her and we had Brian O'Driscoll on next. Boy, Brian keeps coming up in this. He was actually on the studio and I had a jar and I said, I have a man who loves to make a few quid, and I threw him the jar and he caught it and he goes,
very
money maker for you, Brian. But that, like, that's the car crash of life. Telly, and it's morning, and I think people just they enjoy, like myself, Muireann and Alan, we have a great relationship with each other. You know Muireann, she's so professional, she's so over
and,
everything
and bright and up with things.
Oh, big
time. So she adores Current Affairs.
Oh my God, loves it. Yeah.
And she's very quick
and she keeps me right, which is so good.
Good
and
Limerick girl.
And then Alan is just such a pro. He's been there for so long.
Yeah, Alan is a total pro.
He can mix the serious, having the laugh, and just seems to get it right.
And he's working that panto. He's working that panto.
Oh, it's that time of the year.
Sammy's sausages. phone. Somebody's on the phone.
Ring.
It's Ronan O'Gara. Say hello.
Rog, how are you?
Yeah, how's it going, Tommy?
Life and good in La Rochelle. How's the weather down there?
May we? The weather is fucking enormous. It's great.
I see the French is getting better anyway.
Yeah, no, it's coming on. I was going to ask you there about the clothing line. I haven't had any calls from you to do any modelling, any of the jackets or anything. I'm doing my own line of berets over here.
Yeah, yeah.
Any tips for starting up?
Ah, man, the old grey hair, man, it's not a great... The old stress is getting to you, obviously, is it?
No. It's fine. I'm probably the best coach in the world at the moment, so I think you'd agree yourself, Tommy.
Are you going to rope Johnny in to help you?
Well, bearing in mind Johnny's and mine history, I don't know how well that would work, Tommy. But, no, it's clothing. Sorry about the gaps when I talk.
Oh, I know. Oh, I had to do team talks with you, Ronan. I know only too well.
Yeah.
It was kind of... Ronan, remember the time that you used to always tell me off in training, but I didn't know if you were talking to me or talking to someone else because you kept stopping in the middle of it?
That's right, I remember that. Long pauses there. I think it was Paulie I was talking to, but anyway.
Is that me? Paulie, yeah.
No, it's Mario I'm talking to there. Mario?
Yeah?
Will you ask him to tell you about how he started the old clothing range there, because... As I said, the berries are flying over here.
Right, well, that's good.
Yeah.
Well Rog, done, Rog. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Rog. We'll send you out that new jacket for you when the weather gets a little bit colder over in La Rochelle.
Clothing. Was it your idea? Or were you a friend of yours or something? Or who?
The clothing has actually gone 10 years this year. Mm-hmm. So I'm very proud of that. The shoes, Lloyd Bryce shoes, they're going 14 years. Mm. So it was actually back in 2009 I got... Listen, everybody in rugby was opening cafes or bars or restaurants. And, you know, it was kind of the rage. You know, you had Jamie Heaslip with his restaurant and you had Rogers involved in a bar and whatever else. And my parents were both very, you know, entrepreneurial, had their own businesses. So I've always been interested in that. I was doing a business diploma at the time. And two lads from Monaghan, who are my neck of the woods, who've been involved in the shoe industry for generations, were launching a new footwear design and wanted to know whether I'd be interested in coming on board. So I wasn't quite the fashionista, but I thought...
See, I got the impression that you were.
No.
Well,
not...
So it was, they were saying Tommy could be the sort of, almost the front.
Yeah. Like, this would be a great name. You're from Monaghan. We've, like, friends in common. Great great way to start this brand. And, like, the shoes took off, man. It was amazing. And
You sold lots of shoes.
Oh, like, it was... It was great timing. There was nobody else in the market at the time. Like, it was just... It was such... And it was a new story. Like, that's always what you want. Like, you want to be a new business. Yeah. So the shoes were great. But at the time, it was hard for me because a brown pair of shoes is a brown pair of shoes. And, like, you know, there's very little influence I felt I could have at bar just going out there and talking to people who are buying them or the shopkeepers. So I asked them about clothing because I know I buy three pairs of shoes a year. Now, I obviously get a lot more now, but I would generally buy a couple of pairs of shoes, but I'd be buying t-shirts and jumpers and jeans and jackets and gilets. So I thought, like, for every three t-shirts that sold and one pair of shoes, like, why don't we try clothing? And it's something I could get a lot more involved in and become invested in and have a real impact in. So we decided to start 15 Kings of Clothing. That was in 2013. And, like, it's just been really interesting, like, particularly over COVID, you know, stuff like trying to get stuff shipped in and factories and have to get over to Portugal and seeing stuff being manufactured. And I love it. I really enjoy it. Now, it's hard. I'm not involved in the nitty gritty of it every day. But, like, if I see a top that I really like or I see, like, I was on Grafton Street there and I was picking out stuff that I thought that, you know, small details that you can kind of make differences on, send them off to the factories, change it up, and that would be great for next winter collection.
Yeah.
So as myself, I love a pair of good jeans, good chinos, a nice shirt, a pair of brown navy, like, good shoes. Like I'm not Mr. Stylish, but I take pride in my appearance. And it's not fashion, but it's style. And
what's,
I think,
15 Kings?
So 15 rugby. Kings is kind of like 15 rugby players. And I don't know, Kings, it just kind of seemed to work at the time.
And you're wearing one there, actually.
This is it. Yeah, no, I've asked your head to toe in it. So it's been great. And, like, when we started, like, we are competing with Tommy Hilfiger, Superdry, Gant, like, huge worldwide brands. And we're in, like, 240 or so independent stores around the country. We're 10 years in, and particularly an Irish brand to make it to 10 years in clothing and still be cool, somewhat cool, somewhat, like, that people want to be a part of it, want to invest in it, is amazing. And Ireland AIM helps that.
Leo Vradker's on the line. Say hello.
Oh, my goodness, right. It's been a while.
That's right, Tommy. I can't say I really enjoyed our last chat, but you certainly put me in my box.
Listen, we can put those things behind
us. No, absolutely. No, that's why I'm asking you. You know, you're a person with a lot of ambition, personal ambition. You played for Ireland. You like to don the Irish jersey. I'm just wondering, what about it? Consider joining Fine Gael, Tommy Bow TD, Minister Tommy Bow. What do you think?
Oh, my God. Sammy Sausages, Alan Hughes, your good mate, would never forgive me if I joined on that side. So, no, I think, listen, Leo, I think I prefer being on the guy asking the questions on that side of things. Absolutely no way.
Never.
No chance.
President Bow?
I wouldn't mind a big house out in the Auras, actually.
Ucthorod Bow?
Oh, my goodness, that wouldn't be bad, would it? Tell you what.
You know the Draco's got to go for it anyway, so.
And plenty of rooms for my 10 siblings.
Yeah, well, himself, siblings, himself and Hoobs in the Auras, I think,
they are guaranteed to be the next.
Absolutely, 2042.
I mean, listen, the King and Queen of Ireland.
Well, that's it, so, no, the answer is no, is it?
Listen, thank you for the offer. Look forward to seeing you on the couch in Ireland then soon.
See you on the couch.
Well done, Leo. Thank you. That was good. Of course,
thanks,
Leo. You grilled Leo famously on the couch as well for the housing.
We had Mary Lou MacDonald on the day before. I actually thought myself and Warren were even better with her, but again shows the powers of social media with something clipped up.
Yeah.
That, and yes, interviewing a politician, it's very hard to try and get something
true,
and get a bit
it?
Of purchase out of it. And it was only the fact that we had Philly McMahon on the day before, whose brother died from homelessness, that it was really resonant in our minds at the time. And I was able to put it to Leo at the time. And yeah, he obviously, you know, I think that a lot of people come on to Ireland and think, ah, sure, it's a rugby player and Moran, like, sure, they're like, we'd be grand, we'll have a cup of coffee. And
I utterly disagree with you, and you know why I disagree with you. You see, this is the last place where the politician, etc., will expect
exactly
that something like that can happen. And that's the first place it happens. They're ready for it all on prime time.
Big time, big time. And listen, a lot of politicians would say to us that that is the power of going on Ireland M, because they'll go into the local butchers or the bakers and very few of them will say, oh, I saw you on the Tonight Show there the other night. But they'll all say, oh, I saw you on Ireland M. Fair play to you. Or, you know, that was a tough one. You know, so I think that actually Ireland M, you know, we do have the lighter moments and have a bit of crack, but actually the 7 to 8 hours is my favourite part of the show now, because that's the bit where you need to be on the ball, and particularly when somebody like a minister comes on, because that's your, we are forever reading out text messages from viewers who are either fed up about whatever it could be, the hospital service, could be about the Garda situation, could be anything. And it is my role and Warren's role or Alan's role to try and put those queries and frustrations onto the government and the people who make the decisions. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
Tommy, listen, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. You're great energy.
Thank you.
And I can see because of your whole attitude of go on, get out of your comfort zone.
I
can see that we're going to be hearing a lot more about you in all different respects. Maybe not President Bo, or maybe not Minister Tommy Bo, but things are going to happen because you're going to make them happen. It's been lovely meeting you again, and thanks for so much for coming
on
the podcast.
Absolute pleasure, Mario. Thank you.
And that's it from the Mario Rosenstock podcast for this week. Thank you for listening. Thank you to Tommy Bo for dropping in. If you like the podcast, just tell one other person about it. And if you want to get in touch with me personally about anything, tips for comedy, suggestions for guests, constructive criticism, or just old-fashioned back-slapping compliments, I am ready to hear it all. It's mariorosenstock@gmail.com. I'll see you the same time, same place next week. Bye-bye.
Stand out in the new Toyota CHR plug-in hybrid from Ireland's best-selling car brand. It's got a pure EV range of up to 66 kilometres. And when you need to go further, hybrid power gets you there. Right now, you can buy the Toyota CHR plug-in hybrid model for the same price as the hybrid. It's a limited offer, so be bold. Make the move today at your local dealer. Toyota, built for a better world. Terms and conditions apply. Claim based on latest published figures.